Hi, I'm Cliff Roach, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you for inviting us. Got here about 7 o'clock. I hardly got time to be spiritual. But that's all right. Bob's the spiritual speaker. They always take some Skid Row bum and make him the spiritual speaker. My Al-Anon and I are both just delighted to be here. I always like it when we can come together, and I can introduce her as my Al-Anon. You know how they introduce us. Have you met my alcoholic? Sit up, boy. Sit up, sit up. Tell them how long you've been sober. And I love your, I want to thank Mike M., who picked us up at the airport tonight. Usually they send a Looney Tune, but he seems to be pretty... I haven't gotten to know him real well yet, so we'll see. Got a guy picked me up in Houston. And the third time we passed the same statue at the airport, I said, are you lost? He said, well, I've just been sober 3 days. I'll take Mike anytime. And isn't it, I thought it was great that the reading tonight from chapter 2 ties in so well with your theme. It was the man who, I got Alcoholics Anonymous in a car on the way to a meeting with a little guy named Bill Blake, who was an electrician there in Oceanside. I got AA from Bill because he won my confidence. There wasn't anything I could ever tell Bill that he didn't think was funny. He'd done it 3 times, you know. I would say some terrible, dreadful secret. He'd go, yeah. I didn't know anybody else had done it. But he won my confidence. And, of course, sponsorship is very dear to me, as it is to my Al-Anon wife. In our area, we take sponsorship very seriously, and you care enough about it up here to make it the theme. I personally, myself, have never, ever met anyone on the program who I admired who hadn't had strong sponsorship in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon. That goes for AA and Al-Anon both. I've never met a winner who in their background didn't have strong sponsorship. It's certainly been important in my life. Mine was a vicious little Nazi, but, you know, you can find some kind ones, too, if you need them. I never needed a kind one, you know. And I'm not one either, by the way. My sponsor was cruel to me, and I've passed it on, by God. My wife and myself, we're on the same program this weekend, and I think it's really good because you hear the both sides of it. Because when we got here, we were the sickest family probably on the face of the earth. We had 5 children, and God knows they were all crazy. Not as crazy as she was. And she was, and I was the head nut. And we were all hopelessly crazy, hopelessly insane. Nothing would ever have helped my family. It was too late for my family. No human power could relieve my family. Here it is some years later, and I'll put my family up against any family in the world in terms of people that love each other and are doing well, and not that we didn't go through plenty, but that's just the way our story is, a family story, and that's about all there is to it. I'd love to drink. I don't know. You hear people say, I never cared for the taste of alcohol. I always want to say, would you care for the taste of these? Yeah. The hell are they doing here? I love the taste of booze. I love it. I like sour mash bourbon whiskey the best. But I like scotch, too. Scotch is good. And rum. Oh, I love rum. Rum is wonderful. Vanilla extract, I'm not real crazy about. But if that's what you're drinking, okay, let's go. You know. You have to admit it has bouquet. And I just love the taste of booze. I love everything about it. I fell in love with it when I was 16 years old. I was raised in an alcoholic family. Oh, really? Yes. Both my parents died of alcoholism. My mother was only 43 years old when she died. She fell down a flight of stairs in Skid Row in Los Angeles and in a drunken stupor and broke her neck when she was 43 years old. She didn't want to die when she was 43 years old, I'm sure. And when my mother died within three blocks of the original meeting in Los Angeles, in the old Cecil Hotel, she just missed it by about three blocks. And my mother would have been a great AA, I'm positive, because she was a wonderful person. It took the booze a little longer to kill my father, but booze killed him too. And almost everybody in my family died of alcoholism. We were talking in the car on the way in. You know, the scientists were so brilliant here a number of years ago, they figured out that alcoholism is genetic. Really surprised us, didn't it? They said it's a genetic tendency. supposed to be a recessive gene. They at Duke University, they found the gene a number of years ago. They found a little blue gene down at the end of the chromosome going, you know, only has one thing to say, one more, pal, one more. And supposed to be a recessive gene, but not in my family. It's a dominant gene in my family. But I don't care how much genetic tendency you have, it won't do it, will it? Now, there was a real wonderful man when I got sober many years ago. He was a judge up in Ventura. His name was Dick H. He's dead now. Dick Heaton. And he was a big-time judge, and he'd been sober 25 years. But he had been a terrible slipper, and he was talking about the years he was a slipper. He was the president of Mensa. You know the Smart People's Club? He was the president of Mensa. And he said he and this other brilliant guy kept drinking all the time. They kept slipping in and out of the program. And after all this research, they determined that alcoholism is caused by drinking. I figure it's good enough for the president of Mensa. It's good enough for me. You know. And so I'd always said, I'm not ever going to be like them. Remember that? I'm not going to be like them. It was a horrible place to be raised. It was awful. Fists against jaws and people flying around, hide under the bed, try to stay safe. So I couldn't understand why people would do that. Then I was 16. I was going to a high school dance. I was 4'11", weighed 89 pounds. 11 pounds of that was pimples. And for some unknown, obscure reason, this other little weenie and I had a half a pint of that World War II 10 high. Those who are old enough remember that elixir of the god. And we had a quarter party pack, and we got it down. Took a long time. I swallowed it 8 times. You know, I'd go. A normie would have said, oh, the hell with this, you know what I mean? But I guzzled that party pack and I got it down, huh? And you know what happened then when I got it down. You know, you never have to tell an alcoholic. Got one already. Thanks, pal. Pat, come on up and have a cup of coffee. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. We all remember our first drink, don't we? Huh? Ask a social drinker sometime, what was your first drink? They go, huh? Why? I never remember my first taco, have you? No. But we all remember the first drink, don't we, huh? Went down and went boom, like Clancy says. And as you know, the pimples went, they were gone. And I grew a lot. And I went to that high school dance where we were going that night in East Bakersfield. And I was so little, there were only two girls in the school I could dance with, you know, that were small enough. Not that night. Come on, baby, let's go. You know, I didn't care where my face was. Oh, I had a good time that night. Oh, I had a good time that night. I remember about halfway through that night, my brain said, oh, my God, where has this stuff been? Why did you wait so long? Oh, and I was tough that night. Remember? Well, I was always a macho drinker. Any other macho guys here? I did a lot of this type of thing. Hey, watch where you're going. Remember that? Hey, watch it. I bruised several guys' knees that night, you know. Couldn't wait to do it again. few weeks later, I got a chance to do it again. Drank a fifth of port wine. I figured if that half quarter of a pint of ten high would do it, a fifth of port wine would be even better, huh? And it was. I had a blackout. Most of my life is hearsay from now on, okay? I spent most of my life saying, I did? Oh, I'm sorry. Then I married her and it became hearsay. The next morning, I woke up in jail. In jail. 16 years old, I was in Kern County Jail. I was beaten beyond recognition. Something I was to do over and over. Beaten beyond recognition. Somebody had thrown up on my chest. I never caught that dirty... Never caught him. And they're rattling the bars to get people up, and there I am in jail, and I was just terrified. And I remember I said to myself, I'll never do that again. And I never did. I never drank port wine again ever in my life. To this day, I have never drunk port wine. And if you just arrived, you missed my drunken log. Because, lots and lots and lots and lots, I don't know about you, but lots and lots and lots and lots of times in my drinking, I had fun. I'd love to say that in an AA meeting. That's the only place they know what you're talking about, huh? Fun! You said in an AA meeting, all their eyes glaze over, they all go, oh, yeah. But, little slobber runs out of the corner of the mouth. You don't want to say that in an Al-Anon meeting. Ooh, no. Oh, they don't like fun. They have fun. You say fun in an Al-Anon meeting, they go. Any of you guys remember that? Don't you think you had a few too many? I used to say you had a few too few. That's your problem, lady. But you know what I'm talking about. Fun. Huh? Getting beaten to a pulp and go to jail. Fun. Find your car at the bottom of a ravine in the morning. Remember that? Huh? Yeah. With you in it. Fun. I loved it. Couldn't live without it. Almost died of it. If I'd had one more good time, you'd have a different speaker tonight. You know what I mean? It was that close. Because I could not, could you? I couldn't resist it. Even that horrible, stinking, rotten last couple of years. I don't know what your last couple of years were, but I don't like mine. That last couple of years, my drinking, get up every morning. I was a school teacher. Get up every morning, call Ralph for about an hour. Remember that? Nothing left but just you and Oh, I hated that part. My old man told me if you eat breakfast and go to work, you're not an alcoholic. Made sense to me, He never said a word about puking breakfast back up again, so Ralph and off, And I'd go into work sick, always went to work. I was a functioning alcoholic. Went into work and did the job, huh? Talked about honor. And truth and justice, the kids that adored me, And I was working for this jerk that was out to get me. And he'd get me all day. He'd get me and get me and get me. And I'd go home and I was married to her. And I had all these long-haired, dope-fiend children. And life was bad. It was really bad. And I'd go in the bedroom and get that pistol out. I don't know if you had a pistol. I always had a pistol. Just going to check and see if the barrel was still cold. Just then old Mike would come by and say, hey Cliff, let's go have some fun. And I'd say, that's called alcoholism. I met my wife Pat, my Al-Anon. I met her in college, and we entered this 20-year suicide pact together. And we had that dreaded, horrible dual disease. We had alcoholism and Catholicism. And we had a kid every 9 months and 20 minutes, seemed like to me. Every time I come out of a blackout. Who the hell is that? And they're all right when they're little, you know, like kittens. But they grow, you know, and as the years went on, the weirder and weirder and weirder I got. God knows the weirder and weirder and weirder she got. And as they grew up, the weirder and weirder and weirder they got. And so it was a zoo. It was a laughing academy. It was a funny farm. And but I went to work all the time. See, I'm a functioning alcoholic. I do the job. I'm like 95 to 97% of the people, the experts tell us, that die of alcoholism. People who get up every day and go to work and come home and get bombed every night and drink and drink and work and drink until their liver goes, or they get killed in a car wreck, or they're beaten to death. I tried that on the installment plan. That doesn't work that way. Or being stabbed by dull scissors, you know. I remember her the time with the scissors waiting for me to go to sleep, you know. That'll keep you awake for 3 days. One guy said a functioning alcoholic is one whose wife works. We don't tell that one in Al-Anon meetings either. Not funny there. These guys that tell Al-Anon jokes, they annoy me. Usually they're not even married to an Al-Anon. If you knew a real Al-Anon, I mean not a person married to an alcoholic, a person who works the Al-Anon program, you would know those jokes are stupid. Because it would be the same thing as telling a joke about an alcoholic, a member of AA, and said he was in the bar drinking. You know, the stuff they call Al-Anon jokes are before they get to Al-Anon. Okay? You want to hear a real Al-Anon joke? The difference between an alcoholic and a dog. If you let a dog back in the house, he quits whining. Not so funny here, huh? No, not so... I do like the one where the alcoholic guy goes to hell and he's surprised to see this Al-Anon there in hell. So he goes over and he wants to make conversation. He says, sure hot here, isn't it? She says, it's not hot and I'm not here. But we're all getting crazy. But I taught for 3 years in the little town of Manteca up in Northern California, and then we moved to Oceanside, California. Now, Oceanside is just 30 miles north of San Diego, right on the ocean there, as the name would imply. And so we love it there, and we're still there, and I intend to die there. But anyway, I'm teaching at Oceanside High School there, and in 1965, another guy, in 1964, another guy and I, he'd got this surfboard shop down at the beach. Oh, what a deal that was. We're both surfers in those days, and so the mayor of the town gave us this little building right on the end of the strand there, don't you say? Right on the water. Can you imagine? For a couple of budding alcoholics. And the building was all beat up. He gave us the building just to hang on to it. So we painted it all up and put windows in and fixed it all up and got a refrigerator. A few months later, we got some surfboards. No big hurry there. And we had these two chaise lounge chairs. Oh, we loved it. In the evenings, we would watch sunsets. We were sunset connoisseurs, as a matter of fact. We used to measure them by martinis. I would shake it up and say, look, about 8 tonight, Woody. The best one we ever had was a 15 martini sunset. You should have seen. It was glorious. Huh? And the sun and Woody and I went right together. They found us in the morning with sunburned mouths. Remember that? Always thought that ought to be on the 20 questions. You ever had a sunburned mouth? No, get the hell out of here. You're not ready yet. Talk with a guy down in Texas on the 20 questions. He wanted to put, have you ever been run over by your own car while you were driving? I've done that. I belong here. But we did real well in the summer with this surfboard shop, but in the winter, we were back teaching school again. It was February of 1965, and I went down to the shop to fix a surfboard. We were closed, freezing cold, and yeah, it was Sunday morning, and I had a hangover. Yes, really. And I was really thirsty. Oh, really? Yeah. And I went to the refrigerator to see if there's a Coke or something, because I was not a morning drinker in 1965. I was a weekend drinker. Remember that? Take Wednesday off. And I'm a weekend drinker, for God's sake. And I opened the refrigerator, and my pal Woody had been there the night before, and he left about, oh, this much vodka in a half a pint bottle. My dad would call it a lick and a smell, you know. And there was some orange juice in the refrigerator, and I thought, hey, that would put the fire out. And so I mixed them up and drank it and went on about my business. And I'm sanding on the surfboard, working away there in the shop, and that vodka got in the bloodstream, you know, went... And my brain talked to me. I like to watch newcomers when I say that. They go... I want to tell you, if you knew, my brain still talks to me every day, all day. Never stops. But I don't listen. See, I have met the enemy. He lives here. All of them. But one morning, that morning, though, my brain said, shame on you, Cliff. Shame, shame, shame on you. That was Woody's booze. You finished off. You're way ahead of me, you son of a... Why don't you go up to the liquor store and get old Woody a pint? And I did. That's the kind of guy I am. You know? That afternoon, I got him a fifth. And just ended up bory-eyed drunk. I mean, the board was ruined. The shop was a mess. Had resin all over me. Falling down, crawling home, drunk. And I got up the next day sick, of course, and said to my wife, I got to do something about my drinking. I'm getting drunk when I don't even mean to. And she had cut this thing out of the paper about Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't know why she thought to do that. She'd had her sense of humor surgically removed a few years before. And this, it was just the same thing. It's been the only ad we've ever had since the Akron days. If you want to drink, that's your business. If you want to quit, call Alcoholics Anonymous. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and a guy named Stan came out to help me. And Stan died 2 weeks ago with 45 years of sobriety, by the way. And old Stan came out to get me and took me to some meetings there in the Oceanside Carlsbad area. And I realized I'd made a grievous error in judgment. See, I got to tell you about me. I'm highly educated. I'm educated way beyond my intelligence. I have degrees. And these people, to me, seemed like they had the collective IQ of an orange. I mean, God knows I tried to help them. Trying to explain Nietzsche one night. And this one guy says to me, well, we keep it simple here. I said, no shit. Oh, my God. You could have fooled me, Hiram. Do, 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 do. Yeah, I bet. That a sign on the wall said, first things first. Oh, let's hear it for that sign, huh? What the hell does that mean? Better than that, though, my favorite one still is my favorite one. The one I love the most, it said, think. Yeah, let's get right on that, girl. You know. That's my problem, you morons! If I could quit thinking, I could stop drinking. But anyway, I went to a few more of those meetings, and they used to hurt my feelings because I would whine and snivel. And after about 10 minutes, somebody would say, hey, you're whining and sniveling. Well, they didn't know that I was sensitive, too. And so they would hurt my feelings, and I would punish that meeting. I would not go back there again. And, you know, in 65, there weren't that many meetings. I ran out of meetings to punish, you know. But I would go to the speaker meeting there in Oceanside, 6:30 on Sunday evening. And, you know, there was always 30, 40, maybe 50 people. People would come from out of town and give a talk. And I would wait for the meeting to start. I'd sit out in the car because I didn't want to hang around with you. When the meeting would start, I'd skulk in the back door, get the loser chair. You know the one. Somebody else said, I said, give me that chair. It's my chair. And I'm the loser here. And I would sit in the back of the room and judge the speakers. Sounded to me like everybody's name was Clem. You know, and he'd been out of bib overalls about an hour and a half, and wife's name was Martha, and their problem had been drinking. See, Clem and Martha had been good, decent, sincere, worthwhile, hard-working folks their whole lives. Good people, but they drank too much, see, and after they drank too much for a few years, it started interfering with their lives, so they'd come here to the AMA, and put the plug in. And then they had returned to being good, decent, happy, sincere, worthwhile folk again. See? They had been rehabilitated. You know the word rehabilitated? My hero in 1965 was a guy named Eldridge Cleaver. He was a black militant terrorist. See, that was my politics in 1965. Blow it up or burn it down, I didn't really care which. You know, I was for peace. And if you weren't for peace, I'd kill you. And Eldridge had given this great speech a few months earlier. He was talking, in that speech, he was talking about the prison system, about how they were always trying to rehabilitate him. He said, you know what they had never known? He had never been rehabilitated. And you can't rehabilitate somebody who has never been rehabilitated. I don't know about you, but that's how I felt in the A&A. Evidently, at some point in your wretched lives, you'd been okay. I have never been okay. I was crazy when I was 4 years old. I remember clearly when I was 4 years old. We lived on a speedway in Venice, California. I used to stand there, my little short pants, beautiful hair, and I'd just wait for a car to come. And when a car would come, I'd go, wait for another one. You know, people come driving along. Look at the little boy. What the hell was that? Didn't know how to do this yet, you know. That's what I would have done if I'd have known. That's how I felt when I was 4 years old. I lived on the edge of psychosis my whole life. Right on the edge, either way, take him away. And angry and resentful and guilt-ridden and fear-ridden. I had a big black ball in the middle of my belly when I was 4 years old. On a good day, it was about the size of a softball. On a bad day, it was about the size of a basketball. But it didn't make any difference what the size was. That black ball ruled my life. I never had a thought or a reaction or a took it action in my life that wasn't generated and controlled by that black ball in my belly. And if you don't know, and I think some of you do, that's a painful way to live. That's an awful way to live. That's a horrible way to live. But when I was 16, I found that after I drank about 40 minutes, I would disengage, I guess, that whatever lobe of the brain was connected to the black ball. And then like for about 8 minutes, everything in my life was all right. There wasn't anything wrong with me for about 8 minutes. And if I do PI talks, you know, like for the Lions Club and stuff, like, I don't tell them about the 8 minutes. They look at you funny. A little like Al Anon. I mean, you went to jail how many times? How many cars did you wreck? How many times were you beaten senseless? For 8 minutes a day? But see, they live in the 8 minutes most of the time, those people. That's the only peace I had ever had. It was the only peace I'd ever known. And a lot of times, right after the 8 minutes, everything went to hell. But by God, in a 24-hour period, I was relieved of the burden of the black ball, and I was okay for at least 8 minutes a day. And if that's all you'll ever know, that's got to be enough. That's got to be enough. That's all there is to it. And I'm sitting in that Sunday night meeting one night listening to Clem. And I thought, they want me to give up the 8 minutes to hang around with Clem and Martha. So I resigned from AA. You ever done that? Oh, it upsets them terribly, doesn't it? You know. Cliff who? So the next 5 years, I'm in and out of AA, primarily out. I would drink for like 2 years. Well, that's a slip. I would drink for like 2 years and come to AA for 30 days. Then I would drink for a year and a half and come for 30 days. And then I'd drink for another year. One time I came in the afternoon about 4 o'clock. And old Don the barber and these other three guys, quadro. You ever been quadro-stepped? Where they get on all four sides of you? You know, just woo, 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 woo. And oh, they got through to me that day. I mean, I levitated out of the building. I was spiritual. And I had a buddy, Big John, big dope. He was worse than me, so I went over to John's house, pounded on the door, and John, I said, John, we're alcoholics, and we have to go to AA. Big John says, okay. Like me, because I was a functioning alcoholic. Look at all I'm accomplishing. How could I possibly be an alcoholic? Look at the money I bring on. Blah, blah, blah. You know, a story will suffice. 4 or 5 years before I got to AAA this time, the principal called me in one day. He did a lot of that. And the principal had gotten a flyer in the mail at Oceanside High there about a debate and a speech tournament, which was being held 30 miles down the road at San Diego State College. And he said, I was teaching speech among other classes, so he said, boy, that looks like your students get a lot out of that. Why don't you go to that? And I said, oh, okay. You know, I was in trouble, so I said, gee, that's a good idea. And so I found about 8 dummies, wanted to give it a go, and took a half an hour, taught them what I knew. And we went down to this debate and speech tournament 30 miles down the road. We were astounded when we got there. These things are big deals. There were like 50 schools. Like 500 contestants. The boys had three-piece suits with vests and ties. The girls were wearing these lovely dresses. We're in Levi's. What the hell do we know? And they butchered us. We didn't win one round. We got slaughtered. They ground us in the dirt's what they did. Now, I know what kind of drunk you are, but I don't care for losing. And I went in the coach's room. There were about 20 of them in there, and they've been doing this for their pals, their buddies, their compadres, and they snubbed me, it seemed to me. So I hung around all day. You know how we are. We snub us longer that way. And one guy that really annoyed me, he had a lot of hair. That bothered me right away. And it was one of those gray, beautiful gray hair, silver gray, not a hair. It took 9 barbers to get it right, you know. Had about $1,000 suit on. The other coaches did this when they went in front of him. And about 2 in the afternoon, this guy turns to me and he says, where are you from? Boy, I was grateful to be spoken to. I said, Oceanside. He said, oh, where's that? 30 miles up the road. Where's that? He didn't know it, but he gave me a resentment. And you know what we do. I went back to that high school, and I built a speech team. I went through the IQ files of the school, found the 50 smartest kid, stopped the kid in the hall, said, "You're a debater." The kid says, "I don't want to debate." I said, "I didn't ask you that. Get your butt in the room." They went. Other teachers went home at 4 o'clock or so. I'm there at 9:30, 10 o'clock every night. I'm screaming, ranting, raving, coaching. Guy next door to me said, "I'd love to watch them leave in your room wiping the spit off their glasses." The reporter said to my captain, "What's the secret of your coach's success?" The kid said, "Terror." Hey, do you know how hard that is to make 150 people do what they don't want to do? I mean, that'll wind you up. That's the way I do it. I get up in the morning and I don't eat. All day I don't eat. Better that way, isn't it? Better that way. And I don't eat anything all day, and I drink 400 cups of coffee, and I stay pissed off. And in the glove compartment of the car waiting for me, seal and break it, never touch it all day. That's the kind of drunk I am. I don't have to drink all day. I only have to know it's waiting for me when I get through here. And this half a pint of hot vodka, I love to talk about hot vodka in Al-Anon meetings. That hot vodka is just lying there in that glove compartment all day calling to me, huh? "Go get him, Cliff, baby, I'm waiting, darling." And I finish with that last kid in the evening, and I'm just out to that car. The nerves hanging out the end of my fingers that far. My brain's too big for my head. Every muscle in my body's in a knot. Light one of those cheap cigars I smoked those days and open up that hot vodka, huh? Always drank half the half pint. Is there anything in the world better than just into the bloodstream? You know, the nerves go back up in the fingers. The brain would subside and I'd puff on that cigar. Huh? Damn, you're a good coach. And I'd finish that half pint and sit in the darkness of that car and have my 8 minutes. And just before I'd reach over to turn the key on to start home, I'd think about that gray-haired guy down in San Diego. Always gave him about 3 minutes. And then I went home and destroyed my family. At the beginning of this talk, I told you what happened there. My alcoholism destroyed everybody. We were all crazy. It was the late 60s. Three of my kids were in high school in the late 60s, huh? Oldest son is working his way through high school as a hashish salesman. Never had to give him any spending money, I'll guarantee you. Yeah. Used to hit him up for a fifth about once a week. "Yeah, what do you need, Dad?" You know, he had hair down to his butt. You know, his head went like this all the time. Looked like one of those little dolls in the back of a car. You know. Called his mother, "Man. Hey, man, what's for dinner?" Oh, he was a pimp. And the daughters got boyfriends look exactly like him, and we were a zoo. I'm not going to say any more about that family because my wife, my Al-Anon, tomorrow night is going to talk about that. She was there. And she doesn't forget anything. And so I'm gonna let you know that it was a zoo, and I said if I could get rid of this bunch, I could drink like a gentleman again. You know? And I drove them all crazy, but I built the speech team. And after a couple of years, we won one of those speech tournaments. But I didn't say anything to the gray-haired guy. It wasn't time yet. We know when it's time, don't we? And the next year, there were like 12 or 14 tournaments, and my team took first place in every single tournament. 30, 40 schools in the church, we took first place in every single one. But I can wait. The next year there was a tournament, there were 25 schools competing in the tournament. And my team scored more sweepstakes points than the other 24 schools combined. Then I went up to the gray-haired guy And I put my nose right against his and I said, "Do you know where Oceanside is now?" And he just looked blank. He said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Don't you remember about 4 or 5 years ago, you said to me, Oceanside, where's that?" And he said, "We just moved here to Nebraska. I didn't know where it was." Well, I spilled a second cup. That's the story of my life right there. You know what I mean? This guy's in his bed in San Diego for 4 years. I'm up at Oceanside. "I'll get you, you get..." He didn't even know it. And right after that, Pat and I had one of our main events, which the neighbors have come to miss so much. And our neighbors never even got television until after I got sober. They didn't need it, you know. They all had Venetian blind marks on their forehead from watching. And I moved out. I was living down at the beach where I wanted to live anyway with my surfboard. And things weren't going well. I'd said for years if I get rid of them, I'd be okay. And I'd gotten rid of them and I wasn't okay. I was drunk all the time. I was missing work, which I'd never done. And one afternoon I went by the house to harangue Pat about money. And I was haranguing away there. She wasn't paying any attention. The hashy salesman was kind of bobbing in the background there, humming a tune from the planet Pluto. Mm-hmm. And as I look back on it, it was something really stupid. Dumbest question I ever asked. I said, "Dave, what's it like not to have your old man around the house?" And he looked me right in the eye and he said, "It's beautiful." And I didn't know that for a couple hours, but that was my bottom. I had lost respect of a 16-year-old kid. And I didn't know it for several hours, but I went back to that beach, dumb on the beach, and I ran and raved and sniveled and whined. And then I went out and sat on the screen porch and I watched, to this day, still the most beautiful sunset that I ever saw. And about the time that the sun was going down into the water, I had what our book calls the moment of clarity. A friend of mine down in Southern California, Polly, calls it the moment of grace. I like that a lot. You know, the one moment in my life where I had a chance, where I was all out of answers of my own. I didn't have any more solutions to my problems. I was whipped. And I went in the bedroom and dug out this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd read it one of my travels through the program before. And being an English teacher, I thought it was very poorly written. And read a lot better this time, I'll guarantee you. And I read it for 3 days and 3 nights. I called in sick. I didn't go to work. I ate a little bit. I slept even less. And I read that book. If you're new, I read it cover to cover. I read all the stories. And in the second edition, there was a story called The Professor and the Paradox. And he was another egotistical school teacher. And he rang my bell. And so on the 13th of January, 1970, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I was on page 63 again. And if you're new, on page 63, there's a little prayer, which is step 3, the formal terms of surrender. And in my befuddled condition, it seemed like it would be a good idea if I would kneel down on that filthy linoleum floor on that dump on the beach, and if I would read that prayer out loud to myself. And that's what I did. I read, "God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and to do with me as You will. Relieve me of the bondage of self." And when I was new, I looked up the word bondage. It means slavery. Relieve me of the bondage of self. And I've heard hundreds and hundreds of fifth steps my years in the program. And every single one of those guys, the number one defective character was my defective character. Self-obsession. Self-obsession. And the power that runs the universe, when I read that prayer out loud, came into my life. And I've not had a drink since. I've not had a drink since the 13th of January 1970 because of the power that's in this program. And that evening, I was over at Bill Blake's house. The guy I told you about at the beginning, the sponsor. He had tried to help me all the time when I'm going through the program, and I knocked on the door. It was cold, rainy night, dark. I was all alone on that porch. The door opened, the light came on. Margie, Bill's wife, saw me there. Larry, loser, you know, in and out for 5 years, overeducated, obnoxious jerk, loser. I have never seen anybody so glad to see me in my life. Isn't that amazing? I've never seen anyone so glad to see this loser. And she snatched me in the house and poured me a cup of coffee. She said, oh, this is great. She said, this is wonderful. She said, Bill's been crazy lately. He's had nobody to work with. Oh, this is wonderful. You know. And Bill comes home a few minutes later and says, Cliff! Oh, hot! You know, in about a half an hour, I'm thinking, anything else I can do to help you folks out, I'll... Cliff's here. We can start AA now. But, you know, about 3 weeks later, I was at a newcomers meeting. One of the other newcomers said, what do you mean this is a selfish program? And I knew. I knew. When the guy asked that question, I knew. I found out the night I got here. See, those two people knew the great secret of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't have it unless you give it away. You can't keep it unless you give it away. It's just a truth, that's all. The people who spent a year getting this thing ready, they know. You know, 15% of the people, just like the rest of the world, 15% of the people in AA do the work, and the other 85% criticize. That's their job, you know. And isn't it funny? I'll talk at one of these things, come back 10 years later. Who's theirs? Who's left? The 15% that were doing it last time. And they're probably still doing it. The workers work and the critics criticize. That's all. That's the way it is. He was talking about that at the beginning of this deal. But the people who put this on, they know. See, my little sponsor had a theory that everybody who came to AA had a problem of alcoholism, and we got the solution to that. He also believed that everybody had their own kind of set of goofiness, you know, and you got to look at each bird, treat them differently. And then thirdly, he knew that everybody who comes to alcoholism has gifts to bring. I don't know what your gifts are, but I'm sure that if I don't bring mine, I'll have to die drunk. I'm sure of that. And I see all different kinds of gifts around the program. There was a meeting I talked at last week in Long Beach. This young man plays the piano before the meeting. He kind of mellows everybody out, and he plays little introductions to people when they go up. It's terrific. You know, he just brings these gifts. We got a guy in my group. If you're new, he finds you. He's got an antenna. You know, there's 300 people in my home group, just about. But if you escape everybody else, you will not escape Carlos. You know. That's a gift. That's a great gift. My little sponsor was the worst speaker in the history of AA. He used to say, I've talked everywhere in AA once. But you put him in the front seat of a car with a newcomer. He was just absolutely magic. You couldn't escape him. He just had that gift. So I don't know what your gift is. But I want to tell you, that was the last nice thing Bill ever said to me as long as he lived. He's been dead now 8 years. I miss him every day. He was so cruel to me. Oh, he was vicious. I think the nicest thing he said the first few years was, shut up. That's when he felt good about me, you know. Shut up. Can you imagine? I told him, well, I have degrees, you know. He says, so does a thermometer. You know, they stick that sometimes. But he snatched me up. He took me to meetings everywhere. We went everywhere in Southern California. We were gone every night for 2 years. And he took me to the meetings where people were having a good time. He took me to the meetings where they were laughing. And that's what the guy at the beginning was talking about here. That's the benefits of roundups and conventions and that kind of thing. We get together and we laugh. Oh, I love, you know, tomorrow I'll be right there, you know, in the middle when we're all laughing together, huh? Oh, I can't live without that. When we're laughing from the La Bonza, you know, it's some real sick stuff. Oh, I love the sick stuff. You know, alcoholics and Al-Anons laughing together. There's a concept right there. You know, laughing at the same things. There's a concept right there. You know, with our head back, the tears running down our face. And whenever I'm in the middle of that room and we're laughing together, God always comes and whispers in my ear and says, it's going to be okay, Cliff. It's going to be okay because we're laughing. And I loved it to get a newcomer and take him to meetings, you know, and sit there with him night after night. Then one night he kind of goes, hee hee hee. Ah, we got to get you now, you know. Pat and I take these new little Al-Anons to AA speaker meetings, you know, that we love to do that. We're both cruel. And, you know, the guy's up here at the podium, he says, and I fell on the Christmas tree and smashed all the presents. You know. And we're all going, yeah! You know. And this new little Al-Anon's going, not funny to her. But we just take him to another meeting one night. She throws her head back and laughs, and we gotcha. You know, if you're new tonight and you've been laughing, you're screwed. Because you belong, see what I mean? And I love the laughter. I love the laughter of Alcoholics Anonymous. I read a quote about a year ago. The guy said, sunshine is the laughter of nature. And I thought, no. When I read it, I said, no. Laughter is the sunshine of Alcoholics Anonymous. All of us, when we do that fourth and fifth step, you know, when you're turning that rock over and all that stuff underneath there, you sign that laughter. Nothing we laugh at will ever hurt us again. Nothing I laugh at will never come back and bite me again. And that's why we laugh. When I got here, I wasn't laughing, were you? I had laughed in 2 years. The only way I could laugh when I got here was like, you know, that's if you fell down and got hurt. I was sober about 3 days up in Clancy's meeting. Went, what the hell was that? You know, like stitches tearing. I've been laughing ever since. And that little sponsor, he just did. You know, I've always known what's the matter with me. I've always known. Since the day I was born, I know what my problem is. My problem has always been I was not loved enough. And that's true. My drunken parents tried. My children tried. God knows my Al-Anon tried. My students tried. See, but I didn't know something about me. What I didn't know was there isn't enough love for a person like me. Whatever reason, I don't know. But there isn't enough. You haven't got enough. I'm the black hole of love. Goes in there, you never see it again. Me got everybody in the world, everybody in China, everywhere, said, let's love Cliff. I said, is that all? Is that it? See, but the little sponsor knew what my problem was. He never told me. He never told me. He knew I was too stupid or too brilliant. What's the difference? What's the difference if you die drunk? What's the difference if you're too smart or too dumb? But he knew I didn't, had no, I wouldn't have understood if he explained it to me. So he didn't tell me anything. He knew my problem had always been I never loved enough. I didn't love at all. Didn't know how to start to learn how to. I was locked in that prison in there of self-obsession. So we did what every smart sponsor I know does. He made me take loving actions against my better judgment. He made me take loving action after... I thought it was stand at the door and greet people. I hate that. Hi there, what's your name? Like I really give... Pounce on the newcomers. Drive them back and forth. You know... Talk to the wall talkers. We used to have these guys sat in the bathroom and went, well, look at that. As soon as the meeting was over, say, go talk to the wall talker. How are you tonight? Oh, good. Maybe to haul this guy Al around who was a jerk. But I hauled him around because the man told me. I took directions because I didn't have any more answers of my own. I was surrendered. And if you're new, I would heartily recommend you surrender. And so I did what I was told. And this guy, Al, that I had to work with all the time, slipped once more, and I went over to try to help him, because that's what I was trained to do. Go do it, whether I want to or not. And I was telling him, it's okay, Al. It's one day at a time. Come on, we'll go to a meeting tonight. And out of my mouth, before I knew what I said, I love you, Al. And I knew it was true. I knew I wanted Al to be sober as much as I wanted to be sober myself. And that's how we define love around here, if you knew. We care about each other's sobriety. I'll go to the ends of the earth for you if you want me to, if you want to stay sober. Your sobriety is as important to me as my own. You know, we love each other to health. That's what we do. We love each other to health. And, you know, taking all these loving actions, and this feeling would keep coming over me, this real strange, better than the 8 minutes. But sometimes last 30 seconds. What was that? You know. But it became more and more. And you know, I was about a year and a half sober on my second inventory when I came to discover what that feeling is. It's the feeling of being enough. And that's what the actions I've taken in Alcoholics Anonymous have done for me. The loving actions that I was forced to take have made it possible for me to love you and to be enough. And my sponsor made sure I took all 12 of those steps. Huh? He was bad on steps. That's what sponsorship's all about, taking people through the steps. You know, he said, we don't read them, we don't meditate on them, we don't listen to tapes about them, we don't look at our navel and think about them. We take them. We do them. They only require two things, either a change of attitude or a definite, observable action. We take the steps. Every time I think about the steps, I think about it. The old priest is back in the sacristy, messing around, and the young priest has been out in the front of the church. He comes running in. He says, Father, you'll never guess what happened. He said, a young man came in the back of the church, and he was on two crutches. He took some holy water, and he threw it on his left side, and he threw away the crutch. And he took some holy water, and he threw it on the right side, and he threw away the crutch. And the old priest said, it's a miracle. Where's the young man? He said, flatten his ass out by the holy water. You have to take them. And if you take them, they will change your life. If you're new tonight, I want to tell you, I live most of the time happy, joyous, and free, which is the book that told me that's the way I was going to live. And I want to tell you, for a sick, neurotic, angry, hostile, miserable human being like me, the fact that I live most of the time happy, joyous, and free is beyond any imagination I could have ever had. The life I have today is beyond any I could have ever conceived for myself. And it's a result of learning to love you and letting you love me. So if you're new, you don't have to believe this is going to happen to you. You only have to believe that it happened to me. That a sick nut like me lives most of his life happy, joyous, and free. And that's how I live. And I hope you do too. Thank you.